Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 11 a.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is October 18th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off today with the Dow Gold Ratio. I haven't been talking about it very much recently, but there is obviously some competing influences here. On the one hand, gold tends to be the safe haven asset that people move to when they are worried about the value of the currency in their pockets, and whether that is under threat as a result of inflation or deflation, or more likely that it is about negative real interest rates, then what people tend to do is to look for hard assets, whether that is going to be gold or property or art, but of course, gold is, of all of those, by far the most liquid market, and therefore it's a lot easier to get in and out of. So then that is one of the primary reasons that gold tends to be one of the go-to assets when people are worried about those kinds of things. Then, of course, we have stock markets. Monetary policy the world over is becoming progressively more accommodative. Then we have fiscal policy, which is also becoming progressively more accommodative. So there is a lot of money getting printed, and that is likely to feed through into asset prices eventually. But of course, the big question is whether it is in fact enough, and whether there is an urgency in terms of central bank actions. There has been quite a bit of commentary over the last few days about the confab that's going on today and over the weekend with all of the, well, a good number of the world's central bankers meeting to talk about policy, direction of policy. They're obviously going to be talking about negative interest rates and the fact of negative bond yields. But when we start to think about the stock market, stock market is forward-looking. It tends to price in potential growth looking forward. And when we think about what are the challenges out there, well, the US economy is still firing on all cylinders. The employment rate is still at record highs. Unemployment is still very low. It's hard to imagine that there's going to be a recession without unemployment picking up, and in fairness, that is at least a coincident indicator for recessions historically. When we then think about the outlook for the stock market, well, we've been going sideways for 2 years. Gold, on the other hand, has broken on the upside. When we think then, go back and look at the Dow Gold Ratio, well, we've had this reversion to the mean. This reversion to the mean has been somewhat larger than the one that we had going back to approximately 2015 and 16. Now, I've thrown a 60-month moving average on there, which is about a 1,000-day or 5-year moving average. And what I find particularly interesting is that when we then go back and look at whether it was reliable in previous bull and bear market cycles, well, we certainly know that the 1,000-day moving average was a reasonable area of support in the major bull market for stocks between approximately 1945 and 1965. It wasn't quite as useful in the massive blowout that we had from approximately 1996, 1995 onwards for stocks relative to gold, but it was certainly a signal of the top when the ratio started to turn around, and we did get a signal in 2001 for that, so that was well after the peak in the NASDAQ. But then, of course, we also had the turn in 2011, which told us that there had been, well, in fact, it was in 2013, I tell a lie. We'd had a significant blowout in 2011. Silver prices got up to $50, came back violently. That was a lead indicator for the gold market. Gold peaked and went sideways for nearly a year and a half afterwards, and then broke down. That was when stocks started to truly outperform gold, and they've been outperforming since. Now that we're back in the region of the trend mean, there are obvious questions being asked about whether we are in fact still in a secular bull market for the Dow relative to gold, or is gold about to stage a rebellion and to break this uptrend? And this is a big question. I think it is worth considering them now on an individual basis. When we look at the Dow Jones, then there has been an upward bias to trading, with the exception of that spike on the downside at the end of last year, and the price is down a little in here today. Boeing was down rather sharply, but it's coming from the upper side of its range, and Boeing is the largest constituent of the index, about 10% of it. Something that we have seen in previous cycles is that consistent trends tend to lose their consistency at the penultimate high. There is no question that the Dow Jones accelerated to get to its peak in early 2018. It pulled back very sharply. It was the largest pullback we'd seen since at least 2015. That has contributed now to a lengthy range, and the price today is above that level that we saw back in early 2018. Well, what this also suggests is that there is a budding argument as to whether this is a range or a top. If it's a top, then the region of the trend mean will no longer offer resistance. It will no longer offer support. It will begin to offer resistance. We're just not there yet. It looks increasingly likely that this is a bullish consolidation in the region of the peaks. What we have seen over the course of the last decade, and what is consistent with the view that we are in a bull market, is that you get medium-term corrections within the course of a secular bull market. That is most particularly evident when we look at the S&P 500. The reactions have been somewhat more consistent there. We've had one above another. And on this occasion, and I don't have, this is a 5-year moving average. If we look at where this has come through in previous cycles, we've had significant support being found in the region of the 5-year moving average around these important lows. The 200-day moving average has been a much better arbiter of medium-term support during the up phases. It's not as useful during the ranging phases, but it is starting to offer support once more. And as long as that remains the case, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But if stocks go up, it does not necessarily mean that gold has to go down. Gold prices have completed a base formation. And when we look at these base formations, they generally, when once completed, result in major bull markets. There is the clear potential that we could see both gold and stocks doing better. But of course, the Dow Jones is a very narrow measure, and it is populated by companies that generally do have strong, reliable cash flows. And that is not where the risk resides in this market. If we then think about, well, where does the risk reside? When we think about, for example, one of the sectors that has done best in this bull market, which would be cloud computing. I first started looking at cloud computing back in 2012 and 2013, when a number of the related shares were breaking up and out of a relatively long-term base. Now, back then, it wasn't called cloud computing, but some very clever marketing person came up with that moniker. Now, we had a very significant breakout in 2013, and the ETF went up by 50%. A significant number of the constituent shares went up by a lot more than that. Then we had a very profound period of outperformance where the ETF just about doubled between early 2016 and the third quarter of 2018. Now, this is another good example of where the trend lost consistency at the penultimate high, and then it rocketed straight back up to test and or to exceed the previous high and post a new high. But since then, we've had a succession of lower rally highs, and on this occasion, this does not look like a bullish consolidation. The size of the downward dynamics has been much larger than the size of the upward dynamics, and now we are starting to see the first evidence of some resistance being encountered in the region of the trend mean. This is a big deal. This is something that we have not seen in the wider market, and it is something that we need to pay attention to. I'm posting a memo from Howard Marks in Comment of the Day today, and there was a couple of points he was making that I found particularly interesting. When he's considering the outlook and what exactly do negative interest rates and negative yields mean, well, one of the upshots of that discussion was about the time value of money. And when you have negative interest rates and negative yielding bonds and negative deposit rates at banks, it destroys the time value of money, because rather than waiting and thinking about a higher value of your savings in future, then your savings erode immediately in front of your eyes. Therefore, the incentive is to invest and to take risks, to try and find something that has got the ability to grow well beyond the pace of deflation. And that creates an argument for taking on successively larger risks, because the availability of capital and the amount of money that's around to borrow is, and especially in an environment where it is even possible to get paid to borrow money, well, then that creates this incentive to have a massive move in terms of the amount of risk that can be taken on. And I found that particularly interesting. I did find this chart earlier on in the week, and I found it particularly interesting because it is private capital. Well, private capital went up from very low levels in early 2016, and it has been doing not much of anything for the last year. And I only pulled it up because I couldn't remember the ticker, so let's see if we can't get an updated figure. When we think about this index of private capital, well, of private credit, it absolutely needs to hold the region of the trend mean, and it was more favorable in here today. If it, on the other hand, were to break down, then that would be a significant issue. It would suggest that some of the massive risks that have been taken on are coming back to haunt the investors. I've been leery of the private equity sector since I was at a Marcus Evans conference back in June, and I met someone who had just been given $200 million to invest in additional, or to build a fund in early stage companies, and he hadn't the first notion about how to go about it, but he'd simply been given the money because the investor liked him. That's about the clearest evidence of a bubble I've ever seen. And that has to tell us that there are risks being taken in the private equity markets that are unappreciated. We've already started to see some of the signs that it is unraveling, where we've had a number of very high-profile mutual fund investors and managers have seen their funds implode. Neil Woodford has ended what was an incredibly successful career by being kicked out of his own fund and having to close the operation. That's something that has also happened with GAM in Switzerland and H2O in France. So we're starting to see some of these high-profile names doing rather badly. Then, of course, we have the fact that SoftBank has had to step in and rescue WeWork, and they're looking at a valuation now of about $8 billion. I think people will remember that heading up towards the IPO, it was probably closer to $50 billion, and that's a massive haircut in the space of about 6 weeks. So we are definitely seeing some of the risk that had built up in the private equity sector starting to come out, and that does not represent a particular challenge for retail investors. And it doesn't particularly matter either to companies that have got strong cash flows and haven't been particularly involved in the private equity sector. It's a major problem for the private equity companies. It's a major problem for private investors, large investors or institutions that have been committing money to private equity ventures. It's a major problem for pension funds, who have been investing in private equity. So there are obviously going to be ramifications from this bubble. And of course, when we think about it, the bubble that had evolved in the late 1990s was because earnings don't matter. Well, history rhymes, but it doesn't repeat itself. And earnings don't matter is already a very clear and an evident trend in the current market environment. ETF strategies are earnings agnostic. They don't care about whether the companies are good or bad. Then the indices that they track are market cap weighted, and that is inherently a momentum strategy on its own. Then by buying those ETFs, and which are market cap weighted, then that is plowing additional money into momentum, and you then have the clear example of a bigger fool theory. The prevalence of quantitative strategies, which are momentum based by and large. In fact, the only successful strategies that have been quant based over the course of the last few years have had to be momentum strategies because value has not been working. Therefore, we can assume that quant is a euphemism for momentum. Again, this is earnings agnostic. So this is clearly another example of earnings don't matter. And that is a factor of the fact of, or I guess it's a result of massive monetary accommodation, extraordinary monetary policy, and now fiscal stimulus on top of that, which has reduced the risk and increased the incentive to take on risk. But I think that when we start to think about what negative rates do, then it's a further iteration of that trend. So we have moved from earnings don't matter to time doesn't matter. The time to which we will that it takes to get to a profitable situation is inconsequential when the pricing model moves to infinity. And that's one of the clearest trends that have occurred, particularly in the investments in private ventures over the course of the last few years. So that will probably come back to haunt us. When we start to think about what it is that is going to create the next problem in the markets, it's going to be a confluence of these factors. And it's going to, I think, eventually be represented by time does not matter. That is, when we look back on this situation 20 years hence, it's probably going to be we had earnings don't matter, then we had time doesn't matter. And that's, I think, one of the clearest threats that we have out there at present. The issue with companies that are heavily skewed towards the cloud are we have top formation completion characteristics. Shopify is a very impressive service, and they give you a e-commerce in a box, and you can get a website up and running within the space of a couple of hours. But it has a PE of over 500, and that is after it's peaked. It was at 600 a few weeks ago. And it's pulling back rather sharply now from the $350 area. And that does suggest that a lot of the good news is already in the price, which suggests that there's no bad news in the price and ample scope for it. When we look at Twilio, that was one of the darlings of the investment community in 2017, and it had continued to rally through until the peak in July, but now it is well below its trend mean. Well, Splunk was a was one of the most high-profile IPOs this year, and it has done nothing but trend downwards since immediately after the IPO. I've been at a loss to figure out exactly what the company does that can't be replicated by anybody else. And then when we start to think about all of the other IPOs, like Lyft or Uber, which came in at enormous valuations, they are still at less than half of the value they were immediately after their IPOs. And this is starting to come back to bite, because when we start thinking about time and that belief that time doesn't matter, well, it's a really great example of the fact that manias exist because people are willing to suspend their disbelief for as long as the price is rising. That's why crowds are tolerant of contradiction. Of course, time matters. Time matters more than anything else. Time is the most valuable commodity any of us have in our lives. It's something we never have enough of, and we can't get more of. And yet, when the market is pricing in the fact that time doesn't matter, then it is obviously a contradiction and a mania. Well, then this does represent a challenge, because a substantial number of these companies are underperforming in a rather significant manner. Now, when we then think about what is it that can rescue the market, what can start to turn things around, what can help the global economy to do better? Well, the big answer is going to be one, the dollar. The dollar index is now back in the region of the trend mean. And it has pulled back in a dynamic manner over the course of the last 2 weeks. Well, this is now the do or die moment. It is either going to bounce here around the 97 point area, or it's going to fail. The strength of the US dollar has been an inhibiting factor in terms of the performance of just about everywhere else relative to the USA over the course of the last 18 months. The massive outperformance that we've had in terms of the Nasdaq, the S&P, and the Dow over the last few years has in large part been driven by the positive interest rate differential and the strength of the dollar. Well, the US economy is slowing down, and there are I think because of the well, on the one hand, the dollar has been strong because of the interest rate differential, and that is still there, but also because of a risk premium which has been attached to the dollar because of safe haven buying, and or I guess the risk premium has been attached to the euro, to the pound, to the yen, and to the Chinese renminbi. The yen has strengthened relative to those other currencies, and it is weakening now versus the US dollar. It's weakening faster against other currencies. The potential for the trade war to at least pause is, I think, one of the more significant factors, but it is taking some of the impetus from the dollar, and this is a meaningful pullback. It's not the most consistent trend in the world, so it is obviously going to require more evidence in order to truly confirm that we've had a change of trend and resistance again in the region of that psychological 100 level. If the dollar does break down, it will be positive for precious metals, but it will also be positive for emerging market currencies. It will be, and emerging markets generally. And emerging markets have been underperforming for what feels like a long time. So there is certainly that is a bonus for just about everywhere outside of the USA. But then we have the what's going on in China. And if we're thinking about three factors, well, the trade war is improving is one, and that is contributing to the weakening dollar. But the willingness of the Chinese administration to lean on the traditional levers for growth, which are infrastructure development and supporting the housing market, isn't particularly evident yet. And then, of course, you've got the fact that the Chinese economy is slowing down, and that is killing off demand for just about everything. The deterioration that we've seen in the stocks of a lot of automakers is a direct response to the slowdown in China. It's not particularly encouraging either that when China released its growth figures in here today, they came in exactly on the 6% level. It wasn't 6.1 and it wasn't 5.9, and of course that was right in the middle of their expectation for growth would be. So either China's forecasting of economic potential is by far the most accurate in the world ever, or they're making up figures as they go along. What we can look at is copper, and China is by far the largest importer of copper. It continues to steady from around the $2.50 area. The continuous commodity index is back around the 400 level, and it is closing for the first time in a while above this level. If we can get upside follow through next week, then there is the scope that we are going to see this downtrend break and lower prices for the dollar are generally really quite positive for commodities, and that could be the catalyst for a move in terms of commodity pricing. That will start to put inflation back on the page in terms of what investors are willing to give some credence to in terms of risks. Well, the problem is that if the market has been thinking about time doesn't matter because they've been convinced that we are in a deflationary spiral, well, that goes straight out the window if we get bond yields starting to rise and inflationary pressures starting to manifest themselves. When we think about the longer-term trend on bond yields, I think if we simply just strip away the arguments and look at the action in terms of prices, we did have a very swift contraction from 3.25 down to 1.5. And now we've had the biggest upper dynamics from this region we've seen. The moves we've had in the last month have been larger by a significant factor than anything we saw in 2012 and 2016. That suggests that there is at least near-term support and potentially medium-term support around this 1.5% level. There's a great deal of speculation about the question whether the USA is in fact going to have to go into negative interest rates during the next recession, because they generally cut by multiple percent when they are faced with a recession. And considering that the Fed funds rate just does not have the room to do that right now, well, then that would suggest they are either going to have to massively increase the size of the balance sheet, or they're going to have to go into negative territory. That's probably one of the things they're discussing with other central bankers in here this week. I think what's particularly relevant is that the size of the Fed's balance sheet is already expanding once more. They've added in approximately $200 billion to tackle the repo problem, or the illiquidity in the repo markets. But if they do go ahead and create a standing repo facility, then that opens up their balance sheet to unlimited liability. And that doesn't necessarily mean that unlimited liability is going to appear, but it does mean that they could potentially see the size of the balance sheet expand well beyond the $4.5 trillion mark. Well, when we look at the size of moves we've had before, there was a doubling, or in fact it was more than a doubling, from 1 to 2.25 in 2008. Then when it started going up again, it went from about 2.25 to 4.5. So that's not quite a doubling, but it's really not far off it either. Actually, 2.25 to 4.5 is a doubling. Excuse me. Can't do math and talk. Well, what that suggests is that if we're at 3.75, the next terminal value for the expansion is probably around $7.5 trillion. And $7.5 trillion is still a lot of money. And it does suggest that that is potentially where the Fed's balance sheet could go if they do have to start increasing it at a rapid pace to arrest a deflationary outcome. Now, I think that there are a number of lead indicators that are worth our consideration. The first is the yield curve. And the yield curve is most important after an inversion when it starts to surge higher. Now, it is expanding, but the downtrend is still intact. And certainly when we look at the trend, it could yet move even further into negative territory. So that's still a potential outcome. What is most relevant is when it starts to surge higher, and most particularly when it starts moving through 50 basis points on the way up following an inversion. That's really when we do need to pay particular attention to the risk of negative returns on the stock market. So I think that's certainly one thing that's worth considering. I also saw this rather interesting graphic where it takes the Michigan consumer sentiment and takes the Conference Board Confidence Index away from it. And that is still contracting. It's usually when it bottoms and starts moving higher again that we start to see recessions unfolding. So we're not there yet. There is no evidence of that particular outcome either. Then when we look at this graphic from Deutsche Bank, where it plots employment over the expectation of whether it's a good time to buy large household goods. Well, unemployment is being led higher here, but unemployment has not yet started to rise. It's when unemployment starts to pop on the upside that we can have issues. Well, when I start to think about what is it that could create that move, that's why I pay particular attention to Uber and Lyft. They employ, and again, this is a big argument about whether they are in fact employees or not, but a lot, and when I say a lot, we're talking about millions of people rely on these companies for their livelihood. Well, if they go bust, then that is a lot of people who may or may not have been employed, but certainly become unemployed quickly. And that's a significant challenge. It is something that could have a material knock-on effect for the wider economy. So that is something we need to pay particular attention to. If China's economy goes, in fact, into a recession, and growth is not 6%, but it's more like 3%, and inflation is more like 4%, and inflationary pressures are rising in China, the currency has been weak, pork prices in particular are rising, fruit prices have been surging higher. And that is, I think, one of the factors in that has been the massive detention of farmers in Xinjiang. Xinjiang is, in many respects, like California's Central Valley. It is a desert-like climate with access to water, hot during the day, cold at night. It produces the best fruit in China. But when you've got a half the population behind bars, then there's not a lot of farming getting done, and that is pushing up the price of food. Then, of course, you have the swine flu. You have the additional fact that the economy is slowing down because the traditional levers for growth and credit availability are not being provided for. Well, then that is another potential issue. Now, when we think about what's going on in terms of Europe, well, the stock market there was a little bit softer in here today. It's right in the region of the upper side of its range, so it would certainly be comforting if it continues to hold the region of the trend mean. In the UK, the FTSE 350 pushed on, excuse me, 250 pushed on to new recovery highs in here this week. We are at a critical juncture for the Brexit negotiations. The pound continues to price in the potential that that Boris Johnson will be able to muster the support of Parliament to pass his deal. That's a big bet, and certainly if he can do that, well, it's going to be very positive for the pound. Perhaps not so great for the large cap index like the FTSE 100 because of the potential for foreign earnings to suddenly become less valuable in a strong pound environment. But it does remove a headwind in terms of the risk premium for the market. So I think that when we look at the market, there is the potential for challenges. But so far, when we think about Wall Street, then there is the scope that it is going to break on the upside, that we do get an even more bubbly environment evolving before a recession hits. We do know what's going to be kind of strategies are going to be deployed to deal with that. Some sectors are going to be hit more than others. Others are going to be there's going to be contagion because of the exposure that a significant number of asset holders have to the private equity sector. If it's China is the motivating factor behind a recession, then it will be anything that's exposed to China. There is, however, I think the potential that China will try to rescue its economy by pulling on some of the growth levers that it has so far refused to do. Then that would be positive for commodity producers globally. The fact that commodities are starting to turn, that is also representative of something we do look for in the latter stages of a bull market, that you do expect that you would get a move in terms of commodity pricing. I do, however, think it is more likely to happen with copper than with oil. There is just simply too much oil around. We are in a secular bear market for oil prices, and I think they're more likely to range than trend in the absence of a clear geopolitical reason for prices to spike higher, however temporary that might be. When we then think about the fact that shipping prices are rising, then that is also a significant issue because when we think about shipping prices, tariffs, and inflation, and commodity prices, then and wage demand growth, while inflation is not being measured right now, then there is the scope that we're going to get an inflationary scare. And it would be the response to that inflationary scare, potentially even as central banks beginning to stop cutting interest rates and raising interest rates, that would then lead to a future contraction. I think that is something that is not priced into the market at all. It is something that is, I think, a potential likelihood that we need to pay attention to, but I think the most important thing to walk away with is the view that we need to pay particular attention to the consistency of trends. One of the clearest signs that things are going askew is when instruments start encountering resistance in the region of their trend mean rather than finding support there. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.